Labor and Consumer Affairs to order, and to start with, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3439. Janet, a summation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3439 is sponsored by Representative Greg Smith and would require the Department of Economic and Community Development to study privatization of loans made from the Oregon Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund. It requires the department to report the results of its study, including recommendations about feasibility, advantages, and disadvantages to appropriate legislative interim committees by September 30th, 2006. Mr. Chair, in the material we routed you yesterday are some the statutes that are related to the program. It was created in 1991. There's some loans can be up to $25,000 for a five-year period to individuals or businesses, and there's some criteria on the size of the business, et cetera. Mr. Chair, businesses or people are eligible for an additional $15,000, up to an additional $15,000, and if they go through a second application process. Mr. Chair, there are representatives from the department here as well if there's any questions about the loan fund program. This bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Representative Smith.
He didn't get the memo either.
Good afternoon, colleagues. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes Union, Wallowa, Umatilla, and Morrow counties. I also have the distinct pleasure of serving as chair of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. I'm here this morning to testify in support of House Bill 3439, a simple bill with a simple idea, and that is to have the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department look at privatizing the Oregon Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund, and then have this bill worked on down in Ways and Means. Let me share with you the Ways and Means Subcommittee, in a bipartisan, bi-chamber approach, is looking at the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department and the way it operates. Currently, Senator Betsy Johnson and Representative Avakian are working with me to try and figure out how best to ensure that Oregon grows. And part of Oregon's economy, about 90% of Oregon's economy, is small business. And this is one tool that we believe will help in our efforts down in Ways and Means to help stimulate Oregon's economy and to grow Oregon's economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Got some questions?
We got one, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, appreciate you coming in and testifying on this. Economic development is really important to all of us. But I'm curious if you can just explain to me what the advantage of or could be. I know that's what the study is supposed to be about, but you know, what gives you the idea that privatizing these loans as opposed to the system now, maybe you can explain the difference and what kind of impact that might have or that you're thinking it might have, I guess.
You bet. For full disclosure, what I would encourage each of the members to look at is the relating clause, and that's relating to public finance. Right now, the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department operates multiple lending programs. They have the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Program, the Business Development Fund, Capital Access Program, and the Credit Enhancement Program. Down in Ways and Means, we're looking at all four of those loan programs and how best to deliver those services. And what we anticipate, if you folks will work with us, is to take House Bill 3439 and have this serve as a tool to work with all four of those loan programs. Again, this is a bipartisan, bi-chamber effort, but we need a tool down in Ways and Means to help us proactively look at those bills. So, again, it's the relating clause we're most concerned about.
Representative Shields, did you have a question?
No.
Okay, thank you. Representative Escobar.
My fellow committee members,
Just for your information, this is something that we need to have in hand in order to look and evaluate what we're doing in economic development, and it's something that is necessary. It's something that we need to have as a benchmark, and of course we've talked and talked in this building about goals and benchmarks, and this will be one of the tools that we'll be able to do with that. Am I correct?
That's very true, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair. The one thing I would add is we are truly trying to make this process as open as possible, and we would encourage each and every one of you to come down and sit at the dais with us as we work through how best to grow Oregon. And so this is one tool, and as we begin to look at the finance programs within the department and how best to ensure that entrepreneurs around the state are able to use these loan programs, we'd hope you'd come sit there and ask your questions and give your input. You're more than welcome, and we'll put your name tag right up there with us.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Smith. And I agree, we do need to find out what we're doing with our money and what we're getting out of it in a wide range of areas. My question, would you just speak to the privatization part, privatization versus whatever, and then how much is this going to cost, and where are we going to get the money?
You bet. Again, Chair Brown, Vice Chair Schaffer, what I would encourage you to do is to look at the relating clause. Mm-hmm. I would care to contend that Section 1 of this bill will not be there when this bill comes to the House floor. We introduced this bill with the intent of having it sent down to Ways and Means and to work with its relating clause.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative. There's only one question I have. Where's your tie?
I thought it was Halloween. I don't know. If I knew this, I would have put my Eastern Oregon University tie on. So, anyway, Mr. Chair, I truly appreciate this opportunity. Again, members, this is a bipartisan, bi-chamber approach, and economic development and the growth of business in Oregon really should not be a partisan issue, and we welcome you to the dais down there and any other meetings we're having related to growing Oregon. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Could I have Lynn Beaton and Victoria Pruitt? Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lynn Beaton, and I'm the manager of the Central Operations Division for the department. And with me today is Victoria Pruitt, who's the Market Development Manager for the agency. We're intrigued by Representative Smith's comments and questions concerning both the EDLF fund as well as our other three funds in our business finance program. And he's talked to us fairly extensively on some of the changes that he would be interested in seeing. So we have no opposition to performing a study, certainly to look into that, to see if changing and privatizing this program would in fact present the benefits that we think that it might, and to determine what those costs might be. So at this point, knowing what we're doing is studying that to figure out more and to learn more about whether or not this would be the right way to go, that's certainly not a problem for the agency. And with that, I think unless you have questions, that's really the only statement we wanted to make.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much for here to testify this morning.
Thanks.
And there's no one else signed up to testify on 3439, and so I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3439, and the motion should be to send it on its way to Ways and Means. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 3439 to the Committee on Ways and Means to do pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3439 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll?
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. It's on its way to Ways and Means. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2603. Janet, can you give us a summation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2603, and before I forget, it also has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, would reduce the Secretary of State's business registry filing fees from $50 to $20 per filing, and would repeal the requirement that $30 of each fee be transferred to the general fund, and the requirement that amounts in excess of administrative costs be transferred. Mr. Chair, the 2003 legislature increased the filing fee from $20 to $50. It's my understanding that the increase was not due to an increased cost of administering the registrations, but was part of a budget balancing legislation, and the increase was required to be transferred directly to the general fund, or not directly, but after costs to the general fund. House Bill 2603 returns the document filing fee to $20. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Representative Nelson, please.
Chair Brown, Representative Donna Nelson, District 24, from the beautiful Willamette Valley, and I want to know what's going on.
Beaver Day.
Yeah.
Well, I'm surprised.
Where's your tie, Representative?
No one gave me a tie, and I'm offended.
Well, we better get on that.
However, Linfield College,
would you like?
I would.
Here, you can have mine. I'll get another one from that fellow running around. There you go. You're welcome.
What a gentleman.
He'll wear it, too.
Well, that's what I'm going to say that. I do live in the city that houses Linfield College, the national football champions. However, being a great supporter in my state, I'm also very fond of Oregon State Beavers. Chair Brown.
Good, Representative. Then after this fall, you will have the opportunity to be associated with two national champions, maybe, hopefully.
I like that. All right. I'm ready.
Some dreamers.
Chair Brown and distinguished committee members, it's my honor to appear before you once again. And I thank you for your consideration today of House Bill 2603. A brilliant management consultant taught me years and years ago before I really began my career in training management for Evergreen International Aviation Worldwide that one must inspect what you expect. Under current law, whenever a business files paperwork with the Secretary of State, it is charged a fee of $50, a fee for fulfilling its legal obligation to the state. Now, it is certainly understandable that the state takes some role in the regulation of businesses. Regulation leads to paperwork. Paperwork costs money. Therefore, it seems logical that businesses pay these fees to fund the process. However, this $50 fee does more than merely cover the cost of government's legitimate interest in regulating businesses. Under ORS 56.041, I quote, 3/5 of the money collected through these fees is turned over to the general fund for general governmental expenses. Nothing specifically pertaining to the assistance to our small businesses. This isn't merely covering the cost of necessary bureaucracy. This is a covert tax on businesses in Oregon. House Bill 2603 repeals this tax. Under House Bill 2603, businesses are only charged $20 to file required paperwork, which is, legitimately, the actual cost to the state to process these forms. The Secretary of State is not in business. These businessmen are. This is essential, especially at a time when businesses, especially small local businesses, continue to feel the burden of economic hardship as we slowly recover from the recession. Moreover, House Bill 2603 does not interfere with the Secretary of State's power to establish additional fees as needed, unfortunately. There's no cause to fear that the Secretary of State's office will become underfunded because of this tax elimination. The Secretary of State will still be able to charge necessary fees for services such as copying and certifying public records. Besides, it's not like the Secretary of State's going to miss the money. By statute, the extra $30 currently collected is automatically removed from the Secretary of State's operating account, whether it's needed or not. Chair Brown, distinguished committee members, we need to do everything in our power to help improve Oregon's economy. Passing House Bill 2603 is just one of many small steps we can take to reduce the bureaucratic burden on small businesses. Small businesses that hire so many Oregon workers. I urge you to pass House Bill 2603 on to the full House of Representatives. And I thank you for your time. And I will take any questions at this time.
Thank you, Representative. Questions? Representative Kitts.
Representative Nelson, I actually had a letter from a constituent of mine dealing with this issue and this increase. I'm glad you brought this bill forward. Would you be open to an amendment to House Bill 2603 that would require zero fees for nonprofit organizations that do not generate any money whatsoever? Let me give you an example. The people that I'm speaking of are in this small little town, maybe you've heard of it, North Plains. They have an LLC, or excuse me, they are a nonprofit that manages a cemetery. And that's all they do. But for tax reasons or for whatever reason, they had to establish a nonprofit entity to maintain the grounds of this cemetery with the state. They have very little money. They do it out of the goodness of their heart. They don't generate money. They don't solicit funds. So zero money in, zero money out, except for this maintenance of effort. So would you be open to an amendment to this that would require $0 for people registering in this situation?
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, I have great empathy for your constituent who asked for that amendment. I'd be happy to talk with you about that.
Thank you.
I would like to say that relative to Representative Kitt's issue, I do take issue with nonprofit organizations like Goodwill, whereby the director in the state's making $560,000 a year, and the employees there, who many of whom are disabled, do not even make minimum wage.
Is this a yearly fee, Representative? Do you know?
Yes, it is.
And so a nonprofit has to pay that fee, the $50 a year, every year then, huh?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Committee to date, the Secretary of State says in the 14 months that this increase has been in place, they've raised $10.7 million. And the reduction would mean that through the biennium, through a two-year period, they'd raise $15 million with the reduction.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Would you run that over again?
What was that?
They'd lose 15 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Chair Brown?
Yeah.
I think it is so sad that we would do something so useless. I don't think any of our small businesses would complain about paying you know, for appropriate services. But when they're just issued a tax for the sake of helping the governor balance the budget, something is wrong. And we have to remember that these small businesses are the ones that hire the majority of our citizens in our state. Without them, we ain't going to be here. And also, relative to Representative Kitt's statements about the nonprofits, there are many small businesses in that same situation. I mean, he talked about, you know, they try to spend as little as possible because they haven't got that much coming in. Same thing, as small business people.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this discussion. I'm glad I could help you with the tie. I don't know how much help I'll be with you on this bill, but I do have a question for you. I'm a small business person. My wife is a small business person. She employs six people, and they all have good educations. And my wife went to Mount Hood, OSU, OHSU, and is contributing greatly to this community. And these small businesses that hire these beautiful people are taking advantage of and benefiting from, as we all are, these folks' educations. We have to have a well-educated workforce. We're talking about $10 to $15 million, or whatever million dollars it is, that goes into the general fund. That does. You're correct. You're absolutely correct. You haven't said anything that isn't correct as far as the budgeting problem goes, to help balance the governor's budget. Where are we going to get the money to fund Oregon State, Mount Hood, Clackamas, all the community colleges, all our higher, you know, if we continue, today I'm going to vote for a bill on the House floor that's going to help, in my opinion, business in Oregon. Where's the money going to come from, Representative, if we continue to chip away at our bottom line?
Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler, I hope you'll tell your wife that I'm really proud of her, and you likewise for your business endeavors. I'd be happy to discuss this at length with you, but we could certainly start with a bill I sponsored two sessions ago, and that was to eliminate the unnecessary, non-critical programs that have been pet programs of individuals. They're not deemed essential by the public, but yet we spent $670 million over biennium for non-essential programs. They were called the new programs in 2001 and 2. And that's a good place to start.
Well, thank you.
Sure, we're not ignoring you. I'll let you participate.
Representative Brown, Chair Brown, I would like to introduce the man that taught me that you have to inspect what you expect, and it's one of the best management philosophies I've ever known, and I've taught around the world, and this is Dennis Gex.
Good morning, sir.
My time now?
It's your time. Okay. Yeah, identify yourself for the record, if you would, please.
My name is Dennis Gex. I live in McMinnville, Oregon, and I was actually in the Honorable Chair's district for a very short period of time, living 3 miles west of town when you picked up that little part.
That's right.
And actually met you.
Did I knock on your door?
We met you at the door, and you when you were first running, and it seems I'm now knocking on your door. So full circle through this whole issue.
Did he vote for you?
Don't get into that.
I'm sure he did.
I'm actually wearing two hats today. One is an individual who has a small self-esque business that requested this particular bill of Representative Nelson. The second is representing the Government Affairs Council of the McMinnville Chamber of Commerce. I got home last night about 8 o'clock, and there were messages saying this meeting was going to be held today from Representative Nelson's office and also from the chamber saying, we can't get together the group we want to. Will you please represent us there? So that's where I'm at. In the way of background a bit here, I got my bill this last year, and $20 had gone up to 50. And so I called the folks over at the registry and talked to some people there, trying to find out kind of what was going on. What we're talking about in this concept of business registry and renewal is there's one primary purpose for the use of these dollars. The primary purpose of business registration is to ensure disclosure on the public record of the real and true names of persons who transact business in Oregon. That's what it's about. If you have a business, they want to know in the state who's accountable so that if anyone needs a check on that, there's a single source for it to go. That, to me, makes a lot of sense. And for years and years, I've been paying the fee and knowing that anyone wanted to check, they could check and find out. I sent an email to them saying I noticed that an increase in the fee for this annual report registration had gone up from $20 to $50 and asked what would happen if I didn't pay it. And I thought, well, if this is going up, it's kind of nice to have it there, but it's maybe not a big deal. I just won't register next time around, and we'll go from there. On the fee request document, you say that failure to submit this annual report payment by the due date will result in inactive status on our records. Just what does that mean? Well, I got an answer from Karen at the business registry, and she started out with, hi. If you don't pay the $50 annual report fee to renew your entity, the status will become inactive in our records, and you will no longer be eligible to do business legally in Oregon. For an explanation of the fee increase, please refer to our website. And then went on to the website, and I won't go through a lot of reading here, but in effect what happened, the folks from the registration area came in and asked the legislature last time around, please don't do this. We've done a lot of work to bring things to a point where we're handling things quite efficiently in our area. We can do it for the $20, and when you start stacking fees on for other purposes, it looks like we're charging for a service that we're not really providing, and things get real confused here as to what's going on. He said, the corporation division strives to be one of the most efficient and cost-effective operations in government. Our staff is focused on providing high levels of personal service while keeping our costs to a minimum. We have made great strides in the past few years in increasing the public's access to this information. They also went on to talk about what was happening and how these prices had been, or rates had been, a lot higher in the past than we're now. They had brought them down to actually cover what the costs were in the process. So I went to Representative Nelson, asked her if she would introduce this bill. She did, and I much appreciate it. With my second half, there was a letter sent to Representative Nelson. We passed a copy of it out from the local Chamber of Commerce. And this comes from a position taken by the local chamber. And by the way, it's a very bipartisan group when it comes down to the folks that are involved here. The board of directors of the McMinnville Area Chamber of Commerce have taken the position that fees charged for government services should be limited to cover the cost of providing that service only, and should not be increased to provide additional revenue for general fund purposes. Okay. And that's where this comes in balance with all of that. As a kind of a side point, one of the members of our council, Cheryl Hill from Freeland Wade, brought up the other day that there were some other bills looking to increase this fee even more. Seems there's another one in that would take it from $50 to $100. I looked that particular bill up, and in that case, the additional $50 would go to the Judicial Department operating account to pay for department civil case expenses. And so the question kind of becomes in all of this is, where does it end? It costs $50 to provide the service. If I want to do business in Oregon as a sub-S, and I do under $10,000 a year worth of business. It's a semi-retirement sort of thing. To be registered, I pay the $20 for that. Then I pay another $30 to the general fund because others need it. And then I pay another $50 because there's a, potentially, if there's a need for the judicial department to have some more money. And it just kind of, you know, it's kind of a slippery slope to start going on down. So I think actually, when we're dealing with a service, we should be dealing with what it costs reasonably to provide that service, not adding things on top. A very wise lady who happens to be in this room, but I won't give you her name. In this letter from
there's only four.
the chamber to Representative Nelson added these comments to the letter. Small businesses are the lifeblood of Oregon. Adding additional financial burden, of which this fee increase is only one, does not encourage business creation and or growth. Legislation should be focused on actions to make business growth and development easier, not more difficult. We ask you to stand up for small business, to be an advocate for an improved economy. Thank you for your attention to this issue. Please advise us of your position on the issue and your willingness to draft the necessary legislation to effect a change in the current business registration fee. And I'd ask if any of you folks would be willing to sign on as co-sponsors with this. We'd sure appreciate that, too. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kitts.
I'm actually having a copy of that letter that I spoke of earlier made for the committee so the committee can see, and I would ask Representative Nelson to indulge me and postpone this for further consideration until I can have such amendments drafted and bring it back to the committee and talk to the committee about my concerns.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, I would be happy to work with you and consider this.
And I'd love to be a co-sponsor of the bill.
I also. Thank you. Any other questions? Don't see any.
No questions.
No questions. All right. Thank you very much. Rick.
Thank you so much
Thank
for
you
your time.
For being here.
Good to see you again.
Could I have J.L. Wilson, please?
Thank you, Chair Brown and members. I'm J.L. Wilson. I represent NFIB. I have 12,000 Oregon businesses in my organization. I've been waiting 21 months for a shot at redemption on this particular issue because I can tell you, with a membership as large and unwieldy as mine, this single issue ticked off more business owners than you could possibly imagine, and the consequence of which is they thought I was asleep at the switch, and they let me hear about it for each of the last two Decembers when the notices came due. And so I'm in agreement with everything that the representative and the gentleman said. Two points I want to make. You know, this $50 issue is, it's a terribly regressive payment if you're a small business owner, because you've got to realize how many single sole proprietors are out there that maintain a registry with the Secretary of State, and they're paying the exact same fee as a huge C-Corp would. And we consider that to be awfully regressive against a small company. And the second point I want to make is that I would challenge you to tell me how this is different than a corporate minimum tax. If indeed $30 goes to the general fund, I'm going to take anybody to task who says that small business pays a $10 corporate minimum, because in fact the corporate minimum is the $10 to the DOR plus the $30 you pay through this registration fee that goes to the general fund. Tell me how it's different. It's not. You have to pay it, and it's a matter of doing business, and if you don't pay it, you can't do business. And it goes to the general fund. So from our point of view, this is essentially a corporate minimum that small businesses do have to pay, that's on par with you know, everybody else. And so that's just a point that I would like to make. And with that, I'm going to cut it short, say we support the bill, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, JL. At what point does it quit being a fee and start being a tax?
Thank you. It's a great question, Representative Brown, and I think that you can't really divorce the two. But to apply some intellectual honesty, the $20, you know, should cover the Secretary of State's costs. And to that extent, I think it's a justified thing. When you talk about $30 that goes off into the ether for something else unrelated to the cost that should be associated with the fee, then I think you start to talk about the tax issue.
Do you think that government should be more transparent in the fees that they charge, so that the person that's paying the fees knows really where their dollar's going?
Thank you, Representative Brown. In the case of this, I do think it's incumbent that people know what that $50 goes for. That's just a more honest way of doing business.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Wilson, thank you for coming. I'm sorry we caused you so much angst. it with all due respect, sir, it doesn't go off into the ether, and we're struggling here to. You know, you can argue about where the level of funding for education is, but there is absolutely no doubt that we have kicked tens of thousands of people off of health care. We can't keep troopers on the roads. It doesn't go into the ether, with all due respect. It goes into government and government that and services that you know that the business owners you represent demand and need. And my question is, I agree with the good chair about transparency. People, business owners like myself and my wife and all the people up here should know where their money's going. I totally agree with that. I think we should also make it very transparent on the benefits that government provides, not just for poor people and kids and seniors, but for business people too. I mean, there's business representatives in here that have come and spoke to me about the benefit and the value of a well-educated workforce, and I believe you're one of those that believe that too. So I think it goes both ways, and if this is an unfair fee or an unfair tax and it's wasted on something that the community doesn't want, I think I'd be the first one to say, let's get rid of it. But you know what? Like I said earlier, I'm going to vote for a bill today, the Reconnect bill, and it's going to take out money out of the bottom line. And that we just continually, and hopefully to incent investment here in the state of Oregon. But, you know, where do we draw the line? And I it's unfair for me to ask you that question, but I just think we need to get it on the record that there has to be some kind of balance. And small business, once again, benefits from a well-funded education, health care, and public safety system. And that all costs money.
Thank you, Chair Brown. I knew I was going to get in trouble for that comment. I was being flippant. I'm sorry. From a small business perspective, when they see that the fee goes for something other than the service, then I'll stand by the statement because as far as they're concerned, they don't know where it goes. You or I may, but it's kind of inside baseball for us. The question, you know, where you draw the line, I would pose that question with regard to this bill. As the gentleman sitting right here said, where do you draw the line? Does the $50 then become $100 to pay for the judicial department and then become $200 because we want to fund something else? And I know full well the balancing act, and so, you know, that's what we're all struggling to solve.
Representative Kitts?
I would make two points. First of all, with regard to the disconnect or the reconnect, in this case, I don't think that's taking money from the bottom line. I think it's going to be adding money to the top. Second of all, I would also encourage you to vote for that, Representative Shields. the second point is a lot of these services that the state does fund and provide that Representative Schaffler, the good representative from Happy Valley, speaks of, are going to be needed. Things like the Oregon Health Plan, and are going to be needed on a much wider array if we continue to run businesses into bankruptcy and put those business owners on those programs. So I think this is a good opportunity for us to show that we are pro-business, and I would hope that you would read this letter from one of my constituents, because I think it hits home on a much larger problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? Don't say any thank you, J.L. We have Peter Threlkeld from the Secretary of State's office here. Peter, do you mind coming up? And maybe we have some questions for you.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that Peter was the one that supplied the table to show what the other states' fees are. Thank you.
Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Peter Threlkeld. I'm the Director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State. It's my pleasure to be here and answer any questions that you have this morning on the bill.
How many of these fees are paid?
How many are paid? We have right now about 330,000 active business registrations. So I guess the answer to that, Chair Brown, is they're pretty much all of them. The ones that don't pay wind up on the inactive list. And so the current total that we have is about 330,000 active business.
Is there any way to know that how many of these are paid by large businesses, large corporations?
Chair Brown, we don't collect that kind of information as far as the size of the business. I think a comment by Representative Smith earlier about 90% of Oregon business is small business, and I believe that's a very true statement. So, you know, we're probably looking at about 300,000 small businesses. And a lot of those would be the same businessmen may have multiple registrations. They might have a couple of corporations. A lot of them may have an assumed business name. A lot of them are involved in nonprofits in their community. So, you know, we're probably hitting a lot of the same people numerous times.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Peter, you gave us this chart here, right?
Yes, I did.
And I find it interesting that, and I would support a bill that dropped down to $20, back down to $20 for the nonprofits. I would support that in a heartbeat. But I find it interesting, we're at 50 for business corporation limited liability, assumed business. But the first two, I said, were California, Idaho, Nevada, and Washington are 50% to sometimes 300% more greater than us. Yet, oddly enough, our unemployment rate has continued to stay high, much higher than these folks. And I would argue that it is more due to our restrictive, rigid, lack of foresight land use, natural resource use, water use, agriculture, some of those things that I will gladly support adding flexibility to, and the tax code. I will vote with my good representative from McMinnville on creating some flexibility in all and some common sense in all those areas. And I would argue when we do, and I've already done that, and I will continue to, when we do that, and after a couple years of that happening and seeing the benefits to those kind of changes in our statutes, and when the economy comes back around, then I'll gladly return to this and say, you know what, business is booming. We've added on the top, just like the representative from North Plains said. I would gladly come back at that point and revisit this and consider adjusting the whole thing again back down to $20. Because by that time, all my good union pals and union halls will be empty. They'll be out there under them tower cranes, building America, mill and lumber, and that then I will gladly revisit this.
I would, on the second line here, it says business corporation, it says article of incorporation, and you have a fee across there. Then it says the annual report. That's the annual fee that they pay to renew each?
Chair Brown, that's correct.
And I see that we're at $50 and the state of California is $25?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
What happens if somebody goes dormant? And they are inactive because they choose to pursue something. Let's say they get hired in a new job. So they're a small business owner, registered with the state. They get hired. They go do another job for 2 years. And they say, you know, it's not for me. I'm going to come back and pick up where I left off. What happens to that person who wants to go back? Go ahead. I'll wait. What happened? Now mine's ringing. Smart ass.
I thought it was his.
Yeah. All right. I'm turning mine off too.
It was mine.
We're even.
Thank you, committee.
Could you? There's the cyanide tape. I can see it now. What happens to that individual?
Certainly, Chair Brown, Representative Kitts. Currently in Oregon, for any of the fictitious business entities, and that's the corporations, the limited liability companies, the nonprofits, if they go inactive on our records, they can stay in an inactive status for up to 5 years from that date. At any point in time before 5 years expires, they can come back and they can request to be reinstated. So, and at that point, they'll pay basically the back fees. And any corporation that's reinstated is reinstated as if they were never lapsed. So in your example, 2 years, they can come back. They've always been in business as far as the state is concerned.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
So
if I do business in the state, I pay $50. If I don't do business in the state for 2 years and I come back that third year, I pay $150 even though I've not done any business. Correct?
Correct. If you want to reinstate that business entity.
Or I could just go through the whole process of getting a new tax identification number, set up new bank accounts, new credit cards, a new letterhead, and everything else, and start my own new business to avoid that fee, right?
Yes, we could.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
I think I'm on to something here. That's fine. My other question becomes, at the corporate division, I pay my $50 to incorporate, get my name, X, Y, and Z. I'm set up. The renewal that I'm paying, what's that for? What paperwork, what expenses do you go through at the Secretary of State's for the renewal? As if, let's say you took the renewal out and just had, if in fact these people weren't doing business, they're not paying taxes, they're probably on the Oregon Health Plan, et cetera. So what's the need for the $50 every year? I mean, I noticed most of these other states, well, not most, but California reduces it down to 25 from the initial 100. Idaho goes to zero. And Nevada reduces theirs by half, and Washington reduces theirs by two-thirds, but ours stays the same. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, Oregon in 1999 went to a flat fee structure, and the basis for that was at $20, with a $20 for the incorporation fee and the $20 for the annual report fee, that would provide a sufficient amount of revenue to support the operations of the division. And so with that, we maintain the computer systems, the website where you can go and you can search on a business name and see who the particulars are, any of the processing costs that may come. At that time, we changed. If you want to, or if you need to update address information, those are done for no fee in Oregon. Other states will charge you a fee to do that. And we felt that the whole basis of the program is to let the public know who they're doing business with and where they are. We wanted to make sure we had a vehicle for processing and keeping information up to date and current. So basically it funds the operation of the program. $20 initially wouldn't cover the full cost of actually setting up the business account and doing the processing.
Mr. Chair, one last follow-up, I promise.
Okay, follow-up.
Thank you. Would the Secretary of State's office be opposed to sticking with an initial $50 fee so we absorb the increase? NFIB is going to be opposed to it, I understand that. But on the backside, reducing that to $20 for renewals, back to what it was. So because your incurred costs seem to be at the front, not just simply for renewals if nothing changes. Would there be objection that, and also part B of that is reducing the $50, and I would ask Katie if you could give the gentleman a copy of the letter from my constituent also. I would greatly appreciate that. If you'd be opposed to not having a uniform 50-50-50 and reducing the articles of incorporations to $20, back to $20 for the nonprofit corporation, and zeroing out the annual report for these nonprofit corporations, basically creating a subsection within the nonprofit of nonprofits, like I'm going to get you a copy of the letter, that absolutely don't have any funds coming in whatsoever. I mean, these people are, I mean, you can read the letter and see why they did what they did. There are no funds coming in, no funds going out. It's not like certain nonprofits like the Red Cross. It has millions coming in, millions going out. So would you be opposed to an exemption in that situation?
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, back at my office, I have a very similar letter from another Pioneer Cemetery, I believe in Willamina, that letter talks about basically the same thing, and the $30 increase took out their budget for gasoline for the lawnmower to maintain the cemetery. So we did propose a bill, Senate Bill 158, to lower fees for nonprofits, specifically to help out the nonprofit community. So I'd be very interested in working with you and the chair trying to come up with something that was very workable. I would like to say that the Secretary of State does support the current bill. We think that a lower fee for business is a good thing in Oregon, our customers will appreciate that also.
Thank you for being here and answering my questions.
Thank you, Peter. One last question. The lists of businesses and corporations you have, do you provide those to anyone that requests them? And do you sell those in any way?
Chair Brown, all of the records that we collect are public records, so as you know, we have to provide them when asked. We have a number of companies from LexisNexis to Choice Point to all the big service providers that do come and purchase lists from us. The cost of that is set as a means to recover the cost for developing computer programs and extract queries and producing the information on a regular basis.
Any other questions of Peter?
Do we have a butler or contract members if we don't pay any fees and revenue?
No. Thank you very much, Peter, for your testimony today. And there's no one else signed up, and so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2603 and await some further discussion and amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you again, Representative Nelson. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2979. And I'm sorry to read the witness. Janet, will you give us a rundown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2979 was introduced. At the request of the Oregon Bankers Association by the Judiciary Committee. And it, Secretary of State, in addition to what we just heard they do, maintains a central registry of farm products transactions to protect buyers and sellers of farm products. A statute establishes requirements for what's called effective financing statements that must be filed with the financing to register a security interest in farm products. House Bill 2979 is a technical bill that deletes certain requirements of that financing statement. Changes in the Federal Food Security Act simplified requirements for the statements at the federal level, and this is consistent with that and would simplify the process so that it can be more done online. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Tim Martinez and Don Wiley.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. To my right is not Ken Sherman today from the Oregon Bankers Association Council. Rather, we have a real live banker, Don Wiley, who's an ag lender from Umpqua. So if there's any technical questions, rather than having Ken answer those, I've had Don up here today to try to answer any questions on how this process works. I want to begin by commending your administrator. Once again, she's done a wonderful job explaining the bill. I'm going to stop talking to her because she always takes all my key points in my testimony as she explains the bill. But she used the word technical. I would never use that because I know everybody would start paying attention more. But it is a simple bill. I'll use the word simple. And again, what we're trying to do here, and we have talked, just so you know, to the Secretary of State's office, who's responsible for receiving these filings. We talked to them last fall, I believe, and they are supportive of these changes. We are trying to streamline and make it easier to go to online filing. The two ways we're doing this in this bill is, one, we're deleting the requirement that the financing statement, also known as a UCC-1, will not have to be signed by the debtor. Well, that makes it easier for filing electronically. And secondly, as you drive around the great state of Oregon, especially in our ag areas, it's very, very difficult sometimes to specifically identify what piece of land you're looking at, as far as where the crop is. And of course, once the crop is harvested, it's really difficult to try to figure out where it ended up. Excuse me, I misspoke. It's UCC3, not UCC1. And that's why we have Don up here with me. So what we're doing as far as the description of the of where the product is grown or produced, we're upsizing that a little bit, and it'll just be based on the county that it was located in. So, again, I think it's I won't use technical, I will say simple. It's authorized by Congress in the last ag bill reauthorization, and Don and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? They understand it perfectly. Thank you. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2979? I don't see any. With that, then we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2979 and open a work session on House Bill 2979.
I'll move this,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I recommend that we move 2979 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves we move House Bill 2979 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yeah. Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Fulton.
Aye.
Representative Kitt.
Aye.
Representative
Hoffler. Excuse me.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carried. Chair would entertain the motion to place it on the consent calendar.
So moved.
Representative Esquivel moves the House Bill 2979 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's on the consent calendar. Open public hearing on House Bill 2980. Janet, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2980 would specify that a notice of foreclosure sale involving a trust deed is effective when it is mailed. The current law does not specify when the notice is effective. Practice has been that it is effective when it is mailed, but a recent court case brought that into question, and this is to clarify it in statute. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was also brought by the Oregon Bankers Association.
Thank you, Janet. Tim Martinez again, please.
Well, it's still a good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning,
the committee. Tim Martinez again, on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Again, this is, you know, I think a classic example of what we all assumed the law was in a certain area, in this case dealing with when notice is served on a non-judicial foreclosure sale of trust deed. But, of course, having several thousand attorneys in the state, you can always get a different opinion. And in this case, there was there was a case filed in Marion County. It was a two-day case on when notice is indeed served. At the end of the case, the court determined that the existing method was indeed, in his opinion, the law, and ruled in that regard. We would then like to take the next step and put this in the statute so that folks understand that it is effective when mailed. I would point out that it's not simply dropping it in the mail with a 37-cent stamp. It does have to be first class, but it also has to be certified. It also has to have return receipt requested. If you look in various parts of the statute, you will see a whole myriad of when something is deemed mailed, and we think this is the highest level of requirement in the mailing statute. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Tim. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you, Tim. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2980? And then we'll close the public hearing and open the work session. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2980 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2980 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll?
Representative Gilman. Representative Folgate.
Aye.
Representative Kipp.
Aye.
Representative Hoffman.
Excuse.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Mascola.
Aye.
Representative
Gillen. Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move we place 2980 on the consent calendar as well.
Representative Kitts moves that House Bill 2980 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none. And I think it's only fair to point out that these bills are committee bills submitted by the Judiciary Committee, and we have to do their work for them. So I'm very proud of you. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2981. Janet, this is a little bit longer.
Mr. Chair, the bill is also from the Oregon Bankers Association. It's a little bit longer, but it's just repeating a lot of things. It requires Oregon chartered financial institutions to maintain a registered agent and a registered office within the state for the service of process or other legal papers. Specifies a process for changing a registered agent or office and for a registered agent to resign or be discharged. It establishes the Department of Consumer and Business Services as the registered agent if an agent is not designated or maintained. The requirement will have little practical effect since banks already comply, but it does put it into statute and make it clear. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Tim Martinez again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association yet again. Oregon corporations, when they're formed, have to list a registered agent and a registered office. It appears in the mid-80s, when the Banking Act was made its own separate chapter in the ORSs, that provision was not included. So it's not been there since at least the mid-80s. A bank counsel who obviously loves to read statutes and has too much time on his hands in reading the statutes discovered he couldn't find that anywhere. So we introduced this bill because it is important, and frankly, DCBS won't allow a bank to be incorporated without having a registered agent or registered office. So it's, that piece has never gone away, but the statute hasn't required it. So we would like to impose that upon ourselves, I guess I would say.
Does that mean that all the banks that were chartered since that change then are not legally chartered?
Mr. Chairman, no, it does not. I'm sure DCBS is back there shaking that that's the case, because they did require that they have this registered agent, registered office. It just wasn't in statute. So okay. We're putting it back there.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. I want you to stay put there, don't you?
Actually, Tom Perrick's going to do the next bill.
Okay. And then you can move. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2981 and open a work session on House Bill 2981. Who makes the motion? Okay. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move that 2981 be moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves that House Bill 2981 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, we call the roll, please.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. Representative Esquivel.
Mr. Chair, I recommend that we put 2981 on the consent calendar on the House floor.
Representative Esquivel moves that House Bill 2981 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2982. And Tom, I haven't seen the list, but I see you on there. And Greg Olson, also. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I appreciate being here today. For the record, my name is Tom Perrick. I serve as President and Chief Executive Officer of the Oregon Bankers Association. We're proud to be celebrating our 100th year representing the diverse interests of Oregon's commercial banks, savings and loans, and trust companies throughout the state. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 2982. Basically, four changes appear in this particular bill. First of all, we are simply requesting an update to the term of financial institutions to include the trust companies that we represent. The second update would include the term financial record to now include electronic records as well. In the current business climate, that certainly makes sense. The third item in this bill replaces the definition of state agency, which in a prior bill and prior legislature was inadvertently left out. And given the fact that these are the very agencies that request records, we want to know exactly who it is that we're working with. The fourth change is a little more substantive, but also very important. Current law provides that a general rule that financial institutions cannot provide records to these state and local agencies. However, there is one exception, and that one exception provides for allowing police, district attorneys, and sheriff's offices to request certain and specific information over a 30-day period of time. That 30 days is 15 days prior to a specific transaction and 15 days after that specific transaction. House Bill 2982 would broaden that time frame to include a six-month window, or 3 months prior and 3 months after a specific transaction. Additionally, the definition of account information is updated to reflect some additional items that law enforcement deemed useful to their investigations, for example, deposit slips. There is a group that I work with, and you're going to hear from the undersheriff momentarily. A group that I work with is called the RESIC group, Regional Economic Crime Investigation Center. Their mission is to better communicate and aggregate criminal data across multiple jurisdictions, specifically with regard to economic crime, including frauds, forgery, and certainly identity theft. The purpose of that is to make more meaningful arrests and prosecutions. I'm pleased to serve on the board of directors of RESIC, and this bill is a very good product, a very thoughtful product between the public sector's interests and need for public records, but the banking community's a long-standing history of customer trust and privacy. In addition to the RESIC board, the Oregon Bankers Association, we work internally and very closely with our Bank Operations Committee and our Bank Compliance Committee, and we believe that House Bill 2982 continues to provide that necessary balance between the obligations of our customers and the needs of the law enforcement community. And therefore, we encourage your support. I might also point out, Mr. Chairman, that this morning I received three faxes that I'll make available at a later date to the committee supporting this bill, and they come to you from the Chief of Police in Milwaukee, Larry Kanzler, a 38-year veteran of law enforcement, Chief Eric Milgren in Medford, the Chief of the Medford Police Department, and lastly, Sheriff Lucas, Clark County Sheriff, and he happens to be President of the RESIC Board of Directors. Thank you.
Thank you. Greg, you want to provide some testimony? Go ahead now.
Thank you. I'm Under Sheriff Fred Olson, Mary County Sheriff's Office. I've been with the Sheriff's Office for 28 years, and I'm here representing Sheriff Ramirez and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association in support of the changes in this bill. And we as law enforcement and working with the banking community see this as a really positive benefit for our investigations, especially the long-term investigations that we come across in involving fraud.
Thank you. I have a question. Tom, does this these statutes apply then to all financial institutions, not just to banks?
They do apply to all financial institutions.
Any other questions? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, in some of our discussions prior to the hearing, I had expressed some concerns about, you know, the window and trying to understand why we need to go from 15 days on each side to a full 3 months. I guess my first question is be perhaps for Mr. Olson. Maybe you could walk me through how that particular tool would be helpful in an identity theft situation.
Sure, and a good example would be like an embezzlement case where an employee is stealing from an employer, and we can show over a period of time that on X day, amount of money was taken from the employer's account,
and then on next day, an amount of money ended up in deposited in the employee's account. Mm-hmm. And we can show over a period of time, because sometimes these investigations take quite a period of time before we even discover, the employer even discovers that they're being stolen from. And so we use this information over a longer period of time to put our case together.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
And so one of the concerns that I mentioned to Tom as well is that there wouldn't be any judicial oversight of this. Could this information, if you needed a broader window, also be obtained by subpoena?
Yes, it could. However, it might require multiple subpoenas because you find that you don't have enough information, so then you have to go back to another grand jury to get the subpoena. And some of the counties in the state only meet once a month for a grand jury.
One last follow-up. So if you wanted to get a subpoena on somebody's financial information, it could take up to 29 days to get it? Is that what you're...
In some counties, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
I think I know that question, this answer, but I'm going to ask anyway. Why is there any limit on time at all?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thanks for that question. The banking community, and I think the business community in general, our first responsibility, I think, is to our customers and maintaining their personal and private and confidential information. That said, though, we also want to be good corporate citizens and do the right thing relative to communities and helping law enforcement. There's also a significant cost involved, and we want to make sure that that it's not, as I've heard in conversations prior, that in law enforcement's request for records, it doesn't become a fishing expedition, as it's been termed before. So the time frame helps us manage through that process. It focuses the investigation, it focuses resources, and it allows us to help law enforcement when it makes sense.
Greg, do you ever use this type of search in drug enforcement investigations that you may be doing?
Yes, we do.
Is there any other questions? Representative Holley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suppose this question might be for the sheriff. I was curious, is there anything that forbids the law enforcement agencies from disclosing this kind of information to any other individuals or bodies or private investigators?
Well, grand jury's proceedings are secret, and so I'm not certain what the parameters are after the case is put together. I think it's a public record then. But if nothing comes from the case, then I wouldn't guess that there any information is being released. But I don't know the answer for certain.
I guess my follow-up, Mr. Chair, I guess my question is, but say, you know, you've gotten this information and there is no subpoena for information, but this is just in the course of your investigation. I guess my question is there anything that forbids a law enforcement agency from disclosing that information further to other people that aren't part of these law enforcement agencies? To a private attorney or a private investigator, for example, or...
I'm not sure about that, what you're asking me. I don't know exactly what you're asking the question. If the case is adjudicated, prosecuted, and conviction?
No, I'm talking about before that.
I don't know that we've been releasing any information prior to that. We don't release any investigative reports until the case has been completed, except for defense purposes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holvey, if I might take a shot from the bank's perspective on that question. It largely is a one-way street for the banking community relative to receiving information back on any particular cases. There is a wall in place that what we want to do what's right, as I mentioned, and help law enforcement where it makes sense. That information does not go back through the financial channels, for instance, to other bank investigators, fraud investigators, et cetera. So it's not necessarily a loop of information relative to the information that bankers get. We don't get any information back.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Holby, but I think what Representative Holby is trying to get at is you have an ongoing investigation and you pull this information, do you take that out and share it with public if they come in and ask? That's what I think that's it, isn't it?
Mm.
Yes or no? Do we have statutes that prohibits that? We do, according to Dave in the back. Okay, that's. I think that's the answer.
Any other questions, Representative Shields?
Then my final question. I think I'm going to be okay with this. I just this last question will help me understand. On page two, what you're talking about in what's allowed in being provided to law enforcement is just information about the account, basic information about deposits, withdrawals, the name of the person who has the account, but you're not authorized to provide everything about the account. You can't provide under this statute, say, what people spend things on, right? You're just it's a fairly focused approach. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Shields. That is absolutely correct. The information is very specific when it's requested. That is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, General. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2982? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2982 and open a work session on House Bill 2982. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2982 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2982 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Chairman.
Aye. Motion carries. Consent calendar?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields has asked that we not place on the consent calendar at this time to explain the bill on the floor. So
okay. Need a carrier then.
I'll carry it.
Representative Kitts will carry the bill for us. Thank you. And with that, did I close the work session? You must have, huh? Okay. I'm going to close the work session on 2982 and open a public hearing on 2003. Janet, can you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2003 would require state agencies to prepare small business fiscal impact statements before adopting any rule that might have an adverse economic effect on small business. Mr. Chair, current law already requires state agencies to include a statement of fiscal impact for proposed rules, identifying how state and local agencies and the public may be economically affected, along with an estimate of economic impact. They're also required to project any significant economic impact on businesses, which will include a cost of compliance effect on small businesses affected. House Bill 2003 would expand the current requirement, require specific analyses and estimates, require ongoing periodic review of existing rules, and provide a cause of action for a business that's adversely affected by noncompliance with this requirement. Mr. Chair, the bill also sets up an advisory committee to review impact statements. The Department of Consumer and Business Services would be required to set up an advisory committee to review statements. And would allow, requiring the review that is periodic review would be required of agencies every 5 years of all of their rules. The bill does allow for an extension if this is not feasible. And the committee that's set up with the Department of Consumer and Business Services would be also set up to recommend legislative hearings if the proposed mitigation requirements in the bill are insufficient, in the statements are insufficient. There is an appropriation in the bill, and the amount is left blank. We route to your offices the Small Business Administration Office of Advocacy's report on what is termed the model legislation for business-friendly regulation, and it's a regulatory flexibility legislation. And, Mr. Chair, we have at your place today a letter to enter into the record from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Janet. Could I have Bruce Anderson, please? Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce Anderson with House Speaker Karen Minnis. And with me, I thought I'd bring up Connie Marshall, who is the regional advocate for the Business Administration. Thank you very much for holding a hearing today. I really do appreciate that very much. And I'm here to express the Speaker's support for House Bill 2003. It was a concept that was brought to our attention by Ms. Marshall. And just briefly on the bill, and then I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Marshall. You know, regulation, while it is important for us to be safeguarding the health and welfare of people, there can be some rather large unintended cost impacts on business. Some of the statistics, I believe, contained in some of the, I'm not sure if it's in the material that Janet has provided you all, but there's been shown on the federal level at least some cost impacts for business, and I would suspect here as well in terms of complying with it. But we believe, you know, small business can be especially hard hit by well-meaning regulation, not taking anything away from that. But and, you know, especially during this time of economic recovery, state government can be looking towards what we can do to help business and small business. And we believe that House Bill 2003 is a great step and a great bill in that direction. It seeks to bring together, basically, I think, what the bill does is it basically, I think, seeks to bring together regulators in state government with the folks in the business sector to write regulations that are common sense and fair for everyone. And I don't think I'll review it, but just because Janet did copy that booklet for you all, if you look on pages 1 and 2. Of that, where it's under regulatory flexibility, what it is and why it matters. You'll find a great example of I believe, this in action. Back in 1998, the U.S. Department of Transportation was seeking to implement the Americans with Disabilities Act, and they worked with, to make a long story short, worked with motor carriers and bus operators in a way to fashion something that rather than having a one-size-fits-all type of way of meeting the regulation, they worked with the private sector to implement the legislation. And again, I just believe that was a great example of state government regulators working with folks in the private sector to, you know, just design regulations that can work for everybody. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Ms. Marshall and then have a few more comments to make after that.
When I'm finished with my testimony, I did bring some more materials for you, and I will not read the whole testimony. I'll provide a copy for each of you, and it has other examples in it if you're interested in reading those. Thank you for having me here today. It is an honor for me to speak to you and testify on House Bill 2003. As regional advocate for Region 10, which includes Alaska, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, my job is to be the direct link between state and local governments, small business groups, small business owners, and employees, and the Office of Advocacy, which is based in Washington, D.C. My chief focus is to help identify the regulatory concerns of small business by monitoring the impact of federal and state policies at the grassroots level. It is my goal to see that programs and policies that encourage fair regulatory treatment of small business are developed and implemented to ensure future growth and prosperity. This is why I'm testifying today. The Office of Advocacy, as Bruce said, enforces the Regulatory Flexibility Act on the federal level in order to reduce the regulatory burden on small business. As advocacy's research demonstrates, small businesses with less than 20 employees spend almost $7,000 each year per employee to comply with federal regulations. That is 60% more per employee than large firms with more than 500 employees spend, and that's just the cost of federal regulations. By working with federal agencies to implement the RFA, in 2004, the Office of Advocacy saved small businesses nationwide over $17 billion in foregone regulatory costs. This savings can now be used to create jobs, buy equipment, and expand access to health care for millions of Americans. The Office of Advocacy has learned that there are five critical elements that should be contained in Regulatory Flexibility Act legislation. Successful state-level regulatory flexibility laws should have, and yours does, this, in this proposal, a small business definition that matches whatever your state's definition is. Requirement that state agencies prepare an economic impact statement to determine the effect of the rule on small business before it's promulgated. A requirement that state agencies consider less burdensome alternatives for small business while still meeting their regulatory goals. Judicial review when an agency does not follow the rulemaking process so the law has teeth. And a provision for state government to review all of its regulatory regulations periodically to ensure there's a continued need for the rule. To be effective, there should be few, if any, agencies that are exempted. During this time of state tight state budgets, you may be wondering how much it will cost a state to implement. I heard that your cost is blank. Well, the answer is that implementing a regulatory flexibility system can be accomplished at minimal to no additional cost to the state. And I'll share with you two examples. In North Dakota, the agencies were granted no additional funds to carry out their duties under their new RFA legislation. The State Legislative Review Committee is responsible for reviewing proposed rules which the agency has determined using economic impact analysis might be overly burdensome to small business. This duty has simply been absorbed into the existing rulemaking and review system. Similarly, in Colorado, agencies were granted no additional funds to carry out their duties under its new regulatory flexibility law. The Office of Policy Research and Regulatory Review in Colorado's Department of Regulatory Agencies was given responsibility for implementing the new law. To meet the new obligations, they shifted personnel in their office and dedicated part of an IT person to implement their e-rulemaking notification system. So like North Dakota, Colorado simply absorbed the additional responsibilities. The benefits of implementing a regulatory flexibility system truly outweigh their costs. Since December of 2002, my fellow advocates across the nation and I have been working with state legislators like you across the country to make regulatory flexibility for small business a legislative priority. In 2004, 17 states introduced regulatory flexibility legislation and 7 signed it into law. This year to date, 17 states have introduced regulatory flexibility legislation. Virginia Governor Mark Warner recently signed their RFA legislation into law, and Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee signed an executive order to implement regulatory flexibility. And one of the reasons I believe the legislation has been so successful over the last 2 years is because policymakers across the country are realizing regulatory flexibility is an economic development tool. There are over 23.7 million small businesses in the United States, which create 60 to 80% of all of our net new jobs. There's no question that small business is the backbone of the economy here in Oregon, just as it is throughout the country. Sometimes, because of their size, the aggregate importance of small business to the economy is overlooked. Because of that, it's very easy to fail to notice the negative impact of regulatory activities on them. The intent of your bill is to require regulatory agencies to consider small business when regulations are developed, and particularly consider whether there are any alternatives that do not unduly burden them. So this legislation is good, I believe, for the small businesses in Oregon, and the Office of Advocacy commends you for bringing it forward. And what I brought with me today is a copy of the complete testimony, because I don't know if you know, but I'm also the mayor of the city of Bellevue, and I understand what it feels like up there. So I was trying to be respectful of your time. RFA strengthens the economic democracy in the United States. There's articles in here you could read. This map already is outdated from the beginning of the year. We asked for a new one from last year, but it shows you how it's affecting all the states if you're interested. And we brought you facts, just short facts in case you want factoids. I don't know. And then a copy of my testimony. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Connie.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of points I'd like to make, if I could. This I think bringing in this newly created Small Business Advocacy Committee is something that could really lend some assistance to our regulatory system. We're bringing in real people, if you will, from out in the business world to help on review these rules. And just the other point I would make, and that is we do have an existing small business fiscal impact statement that is presently on the books. I think what this bill does is to take that and expand it somewhat and so that we can really implement it so that there is it's a real practical and useful tool for state government. Having been involved in some of these issues in the past on other areas of cost impact statements in state government, this one would definitely expand that and make it very useful. The only other point I did just want to make was that there were a couple of changes. Our office was contacted by legislative counsel on a couple of items that were there mentioned in the bill, and so we would definitely be bringing forward an amendment to make a few changes to the bill. So we'd ask for your support and passage of House Bill 2003, and be glad to take any questions. Thank you.
I think, you know, this almost perfectly fits my business, since I understand what they're talking about. And my wife, who has worked in that business for 33 years with me and had to handle all of the paperwork dealing with all the regulations, mm-hmm. she really understands mm-hmm. what it is. And I very good bill. Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Anderson, Ms. Marshall, you know what I wish, and it's a waste of time maybe to wish. I wish we would have had this as a section in the Clean Air, Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act. Not that those aren't good things, because they are good things, and I think we want to accomplish those goals. But I think in my little business, I have to buy a sign when I'm working in Portland that says, if you have any concerns about erosion on this job site, call this number. Well, then they call the city. Anybody can call it. And that's creating a burden on everybody, even if the ground's flat. And that really frustrates me. My wife wanted to move her business into a new building, and she was going to have the break room was going to be on the second floor. She was going to have to build an elevator in order to do that. Even if she knew she would, in all likelihood, would never have a person in a wheelchair coming in working for her. So I certainly see the need for this. Absolutely, completely, totally. As a matter of fact, I spoke to the burdensome regulations when Representative Nelson was in here about another bill just today, and the need for flexibility and, you know, land use, water use, construction, everything, agribusiness. My concern is, and you probably know the money part, and if I'm going to ask, I can't ask Commissioner Gardner to, Ms. Marshall, you said they were not granted money and then they simply absorbed it, and I believe they did that. But when you ask, if you have 10 people working for you and you absorb more work, that means they're not going to be doing something they were before. And I won't go ask Commissioner Gardner to take men and women off monitoring prevailing wage on a job site and do this. There has to be some money with it, and maybe there is somewhere we can find some money. But that's what I'm concerned about. That's my number one concern. How are we going to pay for it? I'm not the intent, the spirit. I've made it perfectly clear that I agree that we need to do a lot of this in this state. It's just, how are we going to pay for it? Where's the money going to come from? Because I'm not going to vote for something and ask anybody to just simply absorb it. I'm not going to do that, because they're already doing, I hope, I assume, and we need to find out, make sure they are already out there doing important work. That's my one concern about this. Oh, and Mr. Chair, I have a request too.
Sure.
Ms. Marshall, could you tell me, could you get me this information sometime? North Dakota and Colorado did not have any extra money. Could you give me a breakdown of all the states that have implemented this?
I was just going to offer that, sir.
Great.
Because some have and some haven't, but most haven't needed any. Right. So I will prove to you that it's possible, and or you can prove to yourself that it's possible. Our Office of Advocacy, just any of you that are small businesses, you should bookmark the regulatory alerts. The ADA is back, and we're looking at it. And on the federal level, all those bills that you talked about, and they do make any changes, come through our office in D.C. And the new ADA proposed rules is that every small business be ADA compliant, even if you don't have anyone in a wheelchair working for you. That is not going forward. That's retro active as well. That's what our agency does. We are actually the watchdog for small business. It's very independent of all the other agencies. We keep an eye out for all of you. So that's what we're trying to create here, so that there's somebody watching. But it's nice that many of you are small business owners, so you understand completely.
Well, Mr. Chair, I really have a comment on this. You know, before I became a legislator, I really can't say I'm a contractor because I'm not doing any contracting. So much time spent serving my community. But it's impossible for me to be ADA compliant. If you're in a wheelchair, you cannot construct concrete structures. It's impossible. So how do we...
So you would want to go on our website and comment about that, because it would be really helpful as we prepare our testimony to fight that change. So you could just actually, because this one has been so annoying for people, and so many great examples like that, how it's not practical. The ADA, we extended the testimony timeline for that.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, thank you for indulging. That does not mean that in any way I do not support making access and folks that need help have access to the workforce any time we get the opportunity.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Could I have Joe Swinehart and J.L. Wilson, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson again with NFIB, representing 12,000 companies here in the state of Oregon. Just briefly, you know, we picked up this bill in the form of House Bill 2967 and tried to make a run for it last session. It did pass this committee unanimously. It passed the House, I believe, unanimously, something like 55-0, and then we ran out of time in the Senate. So this is not a foreign concept to you or those who served on that committee before. I'm not going to reiterate the excellent testimony in terms of the disproportionate cost of regulation on the small companies and what they have to deal with. The letter from Boley is instructive to me because I see that letter in a different way than perhaps you might. When I see a letter that says from an agency that they have no clerical or administrative staff to perform the functions of this law, I would ask you, you know, with 60% of Oregon businesses employing 5 or fewer and 77% employing 10 or fewer, do they have the time or capacity to deal with the regulations that they may not know about and might cost them? I would suggest to you that they don't, and there's 75,000-80,000 of them here in this state alone with 10 or fewer employees. These are the small businesses we depend on. And when the Boley talks about not having the funds to do this, likewise, do the small companies in Oregon have the funds to comply with every regulation that comes down the pike, whether or not it's makes sense for their business? And so it's definitely a two-edged argument. In terms of the good question from Representative Schaffler, because money is always the issue, I would just say I heard through the grapevine earlier this meeting that 330,000 businesses are paying an extra $30 a year that perhaps you might be able to tap into for something like this.
Touche.
Point well taken, Mr. Wilson. Thank you.
Joe?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Joe Schweinert, Associated Oregon Industries. We have 95% of our members are small business. And I am not going to read my statement. You have that in front of you. But I will say this is a time we need not to impede or put any type of hindrance on small business, because they will lead the recovery in Oregon, and we need for them to grow as much as possible. I think this bill with the Small Business Advocacy Committee will move government and business closer together. I think what needs to be done is we need to be working together for the betterment of Oregon, and what's happening is we seem to be getting in each other's way. And I think this will force the issue where they have to work together. Again, I'd also like to comment on the Labor Commissioner's letter, he talks about the ability to seek judicial review from the agencies with the rulemaking. And I don't think that'll be an issue, because I think what's going to happen is nobody wants a judicial review. So therefore, they will get together before the rulemaking is resolved and decide what needs to be done and what is a problem and what's not a problem, and get together on these issues, which they should be doing all along, and make a rule that is not a hindrance to business. So I would strongly support this bill and urge your support for it. I'd also like to finally say that being one that can count votes on a committee and in support of this bill, that I am a Beaver fan. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Just to comment on the letter from the Bureau of Labor and Industries, the perception I have of this agency is that it should just be the Bureau of Labor, because they don't very often represent industry. Thank you. Any questions, these gentlemen?
Thank
you very much for your testimony. Could I have Jim Nass, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir.
My name is Jim Nass. I serve as legal counsel for the Oregon Appellate Courts. For the record, I did not get the memo about it being Beaver Day, and I assure you this, whatever shade this is, it is not University of Oregon green.
I was going to say your tie's not yellow and green anyway. With my apologies.
Not accepted.
Sorry, I mentioned it. We take no position on the bill. Our focus is very narrow. It has to do with the judicial review clause in Section 4 of the bill. Section 4 would require agencies to do a regulatory flexibility analysis. And then Subsection 3 provides for judicial review, and Subsection 4 imposes a one-year time limit on that judicial review. Our concern is judicial review of what and starting when. The statute uses the word, phrase, final agency action. Judicial review of rules normally happens in one of four ways. One can file a facial challenge to a rule under ORS 183-400. The validity of a rule can come up in a contested case, in which case judicial review would happen by the court of appeals after that. The validity of a rule can come up in an order in other than a contested case, in which case the first judicial review would be by the circuit court. And then lastly, occasionally, validity of a rule can come up in an ordinary lawsuit filed in circuit court. What's not clear to us is exactly what the phrase final agency action refers to. Does it refer to the preparation of this analysis? Is that the action that we're talking about? Are we talking about the rule to which the analysis relates, or are we talking about some action taken by an agency against a small business based on the rule? It doesn't matter to us which one of those it is. We would just like to have it made clear so that we don't have to wrestle over these issues later. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. And I couldn't answer your question, so we'll have to find out that answer. Any questions, then? Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2003? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd ask the rules be suspended for the purposes of allowing Representative Shaw for the vote on House Bills 2979, 2980, and 2981.
Representative Shawford, did you vote on 3439?
Yes, I did.
Yes, okay.
Thank you.
Representative Kitts asks the rules be suspended to allow Representative Shoffer to vote on 2979, 2980, and 2981. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative Shoffer, how do you vote on House Bill 2979?
Aye.
Representative Shoffer votes aye on House Bill 2979. House Bill 2980?
Aye.
Representative Shoffer votes aye on House Bill 2980 and House Bill 2981.
Aye.
Representative Shoffer votes aye on House Bill 2981. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Does Representative Shoffer have any objection to these bills being placed on the consent calendar?
Only if you make Representative Kitts carry them. No, Mr. No, Chair.
Okay, Janet, you have...
Mr. Chair, I have two things to pass out related to this last bill. What is filed under current law, if you're interested. One is the annual report required of the effect on small business by agencies. I have a sample from the Department of Transportation, and I have a sample from the Department of Environmental Quality of when their underground storage tank compliance rule revisions and how they dealt with the small business requirement. So I will pass those out as you leave. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet.
Anything else for the good of the order? We're adjourned.